When Australian Prime Ministers are on the slide, when their MPs are getting fractures, they ambush rebels in the ranks by putting their own leadership to a party room vote. Julia Gillard did it three times, Malcolm Turnbull once. Both were eventually turfed out by their own colleagues. But across the ditch, such brinkmanship is just about unknown. So it came as a shock this week when the Prime Minister, Christopher Luxon, asked his National Party colleagues for a snap vote on his leadership. Luxon won, but refused to take questions from the press.
To put that media speculation to rest, I moved a formal motion of confidence in my leadership. That motion was passed, confirming what I have been saying. I have the support of my caucus as their leader.
Whether Luxon can survive until the Kiwis go to the polls in November is one of many questions I'm turning to Henry Cook for answers. Henry is Deputy Political Editor for The Post in Wellington. Henry, welcome to the show.
Good evening.
Hey, help us Australians. Who's Luxon? What's his story?
So Christopher Luxon is our current Prime Minister. He's a lot less famous than our second to last Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, who needs less introduction. He became Prime Minister in 2023, in our election when Labour was turfed out. Before politics, he was actually quite new to politics. He'd only come to Parliament the term prior. Before politics, he was the CEO of Air New Zealand, most famously, and kind of a general business executive around the world. And he pretty early was picked to be a future leader. And when the leadership of the National Party, Judith Collins, kind of fell apart, not about halfway through that term, he ended up on top, despite having very, very little political experience. He took National to the victory, obviously a victory with two other parties, but still a victory over Labour. So he won a lot of political plaudits for that. But since then, it's probably become pretty obvious that a little bit more time, maybe in opposition, a little bit more time getting political experience might have been very, very helpful for him.
What has he not learned to do?
The big thing Luxon has not learned to do is change gears. He can be a very engaging interlocutor. He can be very interesting. He can be very kind of positive for New Zealand. Can chat through issues really well when he's well briefed on them. But he's always kind of got a very, very forced feeling, sunny optimism to him. Everything is perfect. Everything's great. The last government were the worst government ever, and this government's the best government ever. And that can play a bit strangely to some people, especially when you are facing, as New Zealand is, some pretty dire economic times. He also just, I would say, one of the big things, and in New Zealand we have, much like in Australia, a political culture where you can have very long press conferences, kind of very frequent, what we call stand-ups, two or three times a week with the press gallery. He's not particularly good at sticking on his feet. If a press conference isn't going the way that he kind of wants it to go, he's not particularly good at working out how to get himself out of a scrape. And that can lead to some pretty ugly clips and some quotes that kind of get carried around by the opposition for a long time. And it's that's probably been his weakest point.
It'll also help us over here to explain the coalition that he is leading, because it seems, from this amateur observer, that it's never really settled down.
It's quite a strange coalition. So if you cast your mind back to kind of mid-2023 heading into this election, it looked quite likely, based on the polls, that Labour were going to lose. And it looked like National, our big centre-right party, kind of roughly analogous to the Liberals, were on track to form a government with the ACT Party, who are a party to their right, a libertarian party. It looked like there could be kind of a quite clean two-party coalition, and we very rarely have majority governments in New Zealand. So that would seem, you know, a quite a clean victory for National to just have one other party with it. But in the course of the election campaign and just before it, New Zealand First, who are a party that is kind of encapsulated in one man, Winston Peters, who your listeners might be a little bit familiar with just because of his vintage,
yes.
They'd been out of Parliament entirely. They rode back into the political spotlight and managed to get a substantial portion of the vote, enough so that Chris Luxon had no, he cannot form a government with just the ACT Party. He had to form a government with New Zealand First, with Winston Peters as well. So he had our first full three-way coalition. We've had other governments where there are three parties involved, but they're often a confidence. One of the parties would be a confidence and supply partner on the backbenches, on the crossbenches. This was a full three-way coalition. There are three parties, and both, we have a 20-seat cabinet, and both ACT and New Zealand First have three seats each. They even went for a rotating deputy prime ministership. So for the first 18 months of the three-year term, Winston Peters was the deputy prime minister. And now in our second 18 months of the term, David Seymour is the deputy prime minister. That's the leader of the ACT party. So, and it's quite, in many ways, that they do agree on a lot. Like, there is a lot of comfort food between the coalition. You know, the biggest thing they agree on was hating Labour and hating the last guy.
Yes.
But they're generally conservative socially, they're very, very big on law and order policies, and they can all agree on that kind of thing. But when it comes to some of the economic stuff, it can get a bit more hairy. ACT are kind of pure libertarians, or at least, posit themselves as that. And New Zealand First are a lot more interventionist. They'd like to break up our electricity gentailers, people who generate and retail electricity. They'd like to break up our supermarket duopoly, that kind of thing.
So they're still pursuing the neocon agenda.
Yes, but New Zealand First are very trying to. The best way to describe New Zealand First probably is that they would like New Zealand to go back to the way it was in the 70s. And culturally, that's very conservative viewpoint, but economically that would probably mean a very different, much less neoliberal kind of economic paradigm, less free trade, that kind of thing. There's actually a really big issue kind of riling the coalition right now, which is behind some of these tensions, which is National, Christopher Luxon, is very keen to get a free trade agreement with India agreed, and he has got India to sign up to a free trade agreement. But New Zealand First, who are wary of kind of the immigration settings within the free trade agreement, have used an agree to disagree provision, which means that they can vote against the free trade agreement, and the National Party has to go to Labour to kind of save it and get it through Parliament. And that's caused a lot of ructions, as you might imagine.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr. I'm talking to Henry Cook, Deputy Political Editor of The Post in Wellington, about the crisis in New Zealand politics at the moment. Henry, the big storm that we did read about last year were attempts to wind back the Treaty of Waitangi. Why was that even attempted?
So there's a long run political issue in New Zealand around the place of the Treaty of Waitangi in New Zealand, whether it's kind of a founding document, as many believe, or whether it's a document that matters but is not necessarily something we should base much kind of everyday governance on now. So looking to kind of capitalise and probably really believing in this, the ACT Party and New Zealand First, both parties who are probably on the right of National on this issue, both ran at the last election on some level of reducing the impact of a treaty in New Zealand politics and New Zealand life. Part of that is that a lot of bills, a lot of laws, a lot of government departments refer to the treaty, the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi, when we're talking about Crown Māori relations, essentially, that they'll say that nothing in this act is contrary to the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi, things like that.
Because essentially, the Treaty of Waitangi protects the interests of the Māori people.
Yes. Essentially, and there's obviously two different translations, which brings in lots of controversy. The Māori version of the English version, but essentially, the Treaty of Waitangi sets out the relationship between the Crown and iwi, and that is there is a lot of contentious. There's still a lot of contention about exactly what that means in practice and day-to-day life, and the principles were a way that when the treaty kind of became, because obviously the treaty was signed in 1840, but it kind of gained teeth in the 80s.
The 1980s.
Yes, sorry. When the Waitangi Tribunal was set up, and when the treaty started having more force in everyday kind of governance, these principles were developed that were kind of a good way for public servants to work out what was the proper interpretation of the treaty. The ACT Party were very against those principles, and they thought that those principles had been kind of developed by public servants without proper consultation of the wider public.
The work of bureaucrats.
Yes, yes. So they sought to redefine those principles in law with the Treaty Principles Bill. Now, a lot of historians who would look at it thought that their idea of how to redefine those principles was historically questionable, to say the least, and essentially amounted to trying to change the terms of a contract long after you had signed it. Now, obviously, they would say, well, no, we're not trying to change the terms of the contract itself. We're trying to change how the contract is being interpreted since the 1980s. But, you know, that was the debate. That bill, they got in the coalition agreement, the ACT Party got permission to take it to select committee, so to pass it through first reading. But the National Party did not commit themselves to supporting it any further than there. And the fight back against this bill was massive. There was huge hikoi marches kind of down to Parliament protesting it. Wide sectors of society very upset with the bill. So it got through first reading because that was the coalition agreement. It had to be voted through first reading, but it died there. After that, it was gone.
You mentioned a moment ago economic difficulties. Now, what is New Zealand facing at the moment economically, and is it Luxon's fault?
Well, I think it's hard to ever say the economy is one person's fault, is it? New Zealand came out of the pandemic with fairly high government debt and fairly high interest rates. The RBNZ, our Reserve Bank, hiked interest rates to try to get that inflation down. You can have a debate about whether the inflation was high because of just Ukraine or whether it was high because of government spending and debt. It's a long run discussion. But as the RBNZ hiked interest rates, we entered a recession. And we've had some pretty sluggish, if not recessionary, pretty sluggish economic growth through most of this term. Whenever it's looked like we've got some momentum, whenever it's looked like that, you know, New Zealand's kind of taking off again, Donald Trump's come along. So the last time it was looking like the economy was looking up, Liberation Day happened. We're a trading nation. The US is our second largest export market. So that was, while we've kind of worked our way through it and we've got some of our Kiwi food and stuff going there again, that was obviously a big hit to confidence and kind of hit growth pretty badly.
He hit New Zealand with tariffs.
Yes, he did. Yes, yep. And we've actually got our we've got ways around it and stuff now, but it was still a big hit to confidence. And then just when things were kind of again starting to look up a little bit at the start of this year, guess what? Invasion of Iran, Strait of Hormuz closed. And as much like Australia, much like nations all over the world, a lot of the New Zealand economy runs on diesel. So if there's not enough diesel, or if diesel's really expensive, then things become very hard. And that's where we are now.
And Luxon, of course, comes to power as with a reputation as a businessman, and must have raised hopes in a lot of people that he would therefore be able to get the economy going.
Yes, and I think, to be fair to Luxon and to his government, there is a lot of long-term reform that's happening under this government that probably could result in some pretty big economic growth or changes. Things like fixing up our Resource Management Act, which is kind of our zoning, consenting stuff. We've got a big housing crisis in New Zealand. People haven't been able to build houses as fast as they're needed for a long time. Stuff like that is happening under this government. There's big changes there. But that stuff is not stuff you see overnight. You know, over a three-year political term, there's been a bit of appetite for something a bit faster.
So this week comes around, and why did he move this week to do this preemptive vote of confidence in himself?
So National has been kind of on a slow fade out in the polls over the last year or so, to the point where now they're averaging around 29.6, 29 to 30% in party vote, which is how we vote. There's no two party preferred for us. That's just the primary vote. That's it. That's pretty low for a major party. You know, other leaders have been rolled because the Hardy vote's down at 35%. But we don't really have a tradition of rolling sitting prime ministers in New Zealand. It's happened in the 90s, but other than that, it's kind of a big no-no. Mm. So there's been a lot of reluctance, kind of understandably, from within the National Party and you know, just in general on the centre right to actually do anything about that. But there's also probably every 6 weeks or so a spate of stories about, you know, backbenchers being unnamed backbenchers who aren't very happy with how things are going and hoping Luxon can turn it around or something like that. So there's always been a bit of a rumbling going on, but it kind of reached a bit of a fever pitch as the Iran war has gone on, as the government has kind of not, parts of the government have responded quite well, but Luxon himself has not been seen to kind of grasp the issue and do particularly well out of it. There's been more and more of that kind of back chatter among his party and among people connected to his party. Last Friday, there was a story, extraordinary story in the New Zealand Herald, which suggested that his whip, the chief whip for the National Party, had tried to get in contact with the Prime Minister just before Easter to basically say, look, you've lost quite a lot of support from the caucus, from your MPs, from your party room, and you probably need to call a meeting to kind of sort this out, and there might even need to be a challenge. Now, that story did not get directly denied. So obviously the idea of the Prime Minister ghosting his whip, as it was described, was quite...
Because the whip was doing the whip's job there.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, I should note that the story has now, almost a week later, been basically entirely denied by both the whip and by the Prime Minister, but it's taken a while to get there.
It's pretty slow.
So in the meantime, while that was kind of, while everyone was trying to work out what was happening, two more bad polls came out. One had the party at 29%. And one had the party at 30%, but actually it was rounded up and it was 29.7%. That poll on Sunday night from our biggest broadcaster, from TVNZ, was quite a hit, because TVNZ, their polls have been generally a little bit kinder to the National parties, and also they are, you know, as the national broadcaster, the most seen polls. People kind of go, oh, well, that's the one where
they trust
a lot of people will watch that and will see that poll and will feed that in. So that hit very hard, and the rumour mill was going harder and harder on, you know, people moving against him and disquiet, unhappiness within his party. So on Tuesday morning, the Parliament was coming back after a two-week break for Easter. And every Tuesday morning in the sitting week, the caucus meets, the party room meets for the National Party. We'd usually hear from Luxon on his way into caucus every morning. You know, every caucus meeting, he'd do a brief kind of five-minute stand-up on his way in, but his office said, no, he's actually going to talk after caucus. So it was clear from then that something was probably on. And about 3 hours later, caucus meetings are usually more like an hour, 3 hours later, Luxon came out. He says, look, there's been relentless media speculation. I wanted to put an end to it. I wanted to make clear that I had the support of my caucus. So I put I put it to a vote. I put a confidence motion in myself. I won. That's it. No questions. Having walked off. Now, obviously, in Australia, if that happened, we would probably have the numbers by now.
Well, of course.
Out, read out. Yes. So you'd go, we'd all be saying, oh, well, you know, 16 P's voted against them or whatever it is.
He's what was his P's. Margin? What was his margin?
His margin? We have no idea. So by convention, the party scrutineers, who are the whips usually, they count the votes. They declare the you know, the outcome, the confidence being carried or not, but they do not actually give the numbers to anyone. They don't give the numbers to the leader, they don't give the numbers to anything. So the National Party generally operates on secret votes, and this is a secret vote, and we don't know. So the Prime Minister can say that he's not sure, basically. He you know, that's a reasonable position. Obviously, he'd probably have an idea from in the room who was supporting him and who wasn't, but the actual number of the vote, we'll probably never know.
But Henry, he must know. How can a Prime Minister not know what his support in caucus is? That's impossible.
That is a very interesting question. You would think he would, and it does appear that in the last week or so he has people doing the numbers, as they say, calling around and trying to get an idea of his support. Because on Monday morning, before this all happened, he went on Mike Hosking, News Talk ZB, his favourite talkback host, who he has interviews with every week, and said, out of unbidden, that there were five troublemakers within the party, seemingly looking to kind of minimise the number of people, because obviously people at this time were talking about, you know, a majority against them. He said, no, there was five troublemakers, which was quite extraordinary, because until that point he'd been saying, no, my whole caucus is behind me. So it seems that someone did the numbers for him over the weekend, and he thinks there's about five MPs who are against them. The real thing is, what's a troublemaker and what's a grumbling MP? Because it's fairly clear, if you talk to enough National MPs, that a lot of them are very unhappy. But being unhappy with your leader when he's the Prime Minister is a long way away from wanting to actually roll him. You might not mind if he had to resign because of some kind of urgent issue, but you still don't want to actually go through the bloodletting, the transaction costs of getting rid of him.
So, Henry, in short, will he survive to November?
I would say, at this point, it's probably still just more likely that he does just because of the inner kind of small C conservatism of the National Party on not wanting to roll sitting prime ministers. As I said, we've only ever had one sitting prime minister actually rolled in New Zealand, and the person who, and, you know, when it happened, they lost. That was Jenny Shipley rolling Jim Bolger in 1997. And it's worth noting as well that the last time there was a rolling, when that happened, Winston Peters was also in coalition. New Zealand First was also in coalition with the National Party, and he walked out of cabinet over it and tried to bring down the government. He didn't quite manage to do that because there were some MPs who decided to stay. But the coalition dynamics are really crucial here, because Winston Peters has already kind of kicked off about the fact that he wasn't consulted on the confidence vote. And it suits him quite well to have a fairly weak prime minister. And you'd have to think that if that's playing a lot into any plotter's mind, that if they do, you know, switch the prime minister out, they might have to deal with the government falling around them and having an early election, which would be quite a big problem. So I think probably just the most likely outcome is that he does make it to November. I think reasonable people could disagree with me on that. I think it's a line call, because realistically, if the polls don't turn around, if he doesn't get out of the 20s and into the 30s, and definitely doesn't get lower into the 20s, then, well, the National Party is supposed to be a meritocracy, and if he can't get the numbers up, then they definitely could roll him. But as I said, I think the more likely outcome is he survives, but it's only just.
Is there any remote possibility that Winston Peters, who has been there forever, could end up Prime Minister?
It would have to be, look, in this time of you know, reform polling higher than any other party in the UK, and Pauline Hanson going so well in Australia, you can't ever rule these kind of things out. But I will say, it would have to, I think in New Zealand, you would have to be the leader of either the second largest or the largest party for the kind of country to accept you as Prime Minister. I don't see a scenario where Winston's at 20% and National's at 30%, but he says the only cost of me going in is me being Prime Minister. It's just a bit far-fetched. I think too many people would feel, and the public would feel, that wasn't right.
That's New Zealand. Henry, thanks so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you so much. Lots to talk about.
There's a lot to talk about, and we covered a lot of ground. I've been talking to Henry Cook, Deputy Political Editor for The Post in New Zealand. This is Late Night Live.